And now this word from our sponsor. Have you lost your appetite for politics? Not interested in big elections? Do you feel ambivalent every 4 years? You may be suffering from electile dysfunction. Now, from the leading maker of voter enhancement drugs, try new Votegra. You'll be back in the booth in no time. And your Chad won't be dangling. People who took Votegra while watching campaign commercials had side effects similar to placebo, nausea, drowsiness, and ennui. Call your doctor if you experience elections lasting longer than 72 hours. Offer not good in Florida.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to Is a Bright Future for Healthcare Possible? Dr. Donald Berwick, who studies management of healthcare systems to improve trade-offs among quality, safety, and costs, has concluded that any healthcare funding plan that is just, equitable, civilized, and humane must be redistributional of wealth from the richer among us to the poor and the less fortunate.
My miracles, and we have to pay homage to those. Dr. Murray, a wonderful, gracious man, won the Nobel Prize because he was the first person to do a renal transplant. Bravo, miracles. We want them, and with luck, we're going to continue to have them. But we need new bridges. These bridges are the bridges to prevention, the bridges to thriving despite chronic illness, the bridges to care in communities, community-based, not institutionally-based, the bridge to health. And this talk is focused on what's in the way in terms of building them. It's a scary talk. Politics now isn't helping right now. It's polarized. It's contentious. A political discourse doesn't know what the improvement movement knows. It doesn't share as central the tenets of modern improvement, customer focus, joy in work, the knowledge that all improvement is change. Change is a good thing, not a bad thing. It doesn't understand how to learn by testing changes. Far too few political leaders, I think, really understand, I think, that the best route to lower cost is better quality. People in the improvement movement get excited by the idea of a new river to cross, but politics doesn't. So what we get from the political arena is soundbite grenades, thoughtless incivility. Just when we need tolerance for complexity, respectful dialogue, even when we disagree, especially when we disagree, this is missing, and this is very sad. It will pass. Our nation is a strong nation. Our people are good people. And government will come again, I think, I hope, soon to reflect that strength and goodness. But meanwhile, I will tell you there is much too much silence about the problems that we have to talk about if we're going to make progress. We've all been taught this silence. The problems are like Voldemort, if you've read Harry Potter. Remember Voldemort? Voldemort is he who shall not be named. So we say, we better not go there. People might think we're doing something wrong now. This isn't going to work. 10 years ago, Gloria Steinem, the great leader of the feminist movement, spoke at the IHI's national meeting. At that time, we were wondering how to form a movement for improvement, which became the IHI's 100,000 Lives campaign. She told us that one of the essential steps in mobilization is to give the problem a name, name the enemy. She said we couldn't fight date rape until we had the name date rape. Europeans, more than Americans, use the term civil society. And I think that these words, civil society, point toward the daylight. Civil means non-governmental. It means decorous. It means respectful, public, courteous. Society is a word for civilized interaction, for dignified associations. And my premise with you is that what politics has temporarily made unspoken, hidden, the third rails in public debate, these become an urgent agenda in the civil society space, and that is you, that is us. We are a civil society. We have a job to do, and that job is metaphorically moving the bridge to the river. Bickering tribes aren't going to do that. Soloists aren't going to do it. It's going to be done all together. And so follow me. It gets a little dark. I'm going to name some things. I should tell you, Nathaniel, by the way, has become an expert on being frightened. He's at age 3, he just discovered monsters a couple months ago. So we can't have bedtime until we, and I mean we, check the walls, we check the closets, we check under the bed, make sure the coast is clear. So far, no monsters. So I'm going to kind of have us check under our bed. I'm going to mention 11 hard-to-mention topics. I will tell you, each of the things I'm going to describe to you needs the very best minds. It needs the most creative expeditions we could organize in American healthcare. But most of them, not all of them, but most of them are more or less off-limits in political conversation. But it doesn't have to be for us. Now, this is where we're going to get technical. I'm going to go through four areas, four clusters of monsters. A cluster related to using knowledge properly, a cluster related to waste, non-value-added activity, a cluster related to the priorities we really should be engaging in healthcare reform, and then there's a singleton which has to do with business transitions. Let's start with the first cluster, using knowledge. Confidence in science. An incomplete triumph of the 20th century in healthcare was to decide to connect medical decisions to science, to treat patients according to facts, not according to myths or habits. It is an incomplete triumph because we don't always do it. We don't very easily move knowledge from laboratory bench to bedside. It takes a long time. Partly, also, we've allowed senseless, unscientific variation to masquerade as autonomy. The result is a confused public, and now it has become a suspicious public. The public's been made suspicious by exploitive accusations that scientific thought is elitist thought, that appealing to science is an excuse to take advantage of individuals. It's an excuse, it's a way to deny people what they need. We say science or evidence-based medicine, and a lot of the public here is rationing or even eugenics. And that is just plain wrong. In fact, it's the opposite of the truth. It's exactly science that can protect us from rationing by allowing us to distinguish waste from health. The second monster under the bed is, I call, using global brains. In Washington, D.C., when you're publicly discussing solutions to very tough problems, you will notice that a pervasive rule is in force, and that rule is this: never mention another country. If you do, you're going to take some cheap shots, demagogic shots around socialism or even disloyalty. Not thinking globally hurts us. Okay, Americans are exceptional, I admit it. So are Swedes, so are Basques, so are Oregonians, so are Londoners. We all differ. We differ gloriously. We differ in heritage and talent and resources. Everyone is exceptional. Being different isn't a bad thing. What's bad is when you miss the chance to learn from the differences. Our solutions in America, they're going to be our own solutions, but we can still think of our differences as vast natural experiments. They can teach us tons. Penicillin was discovered in Paddington, and it's used in Peoria. This, of course, is, I admit, a personal issue for me, partly because I have so much learned and valued my relationships with colleagues all over the world, but also because demagogues distorted and exploited the simple fact that I had praised some elements of the British National Health Service. By no means all elements of it, but some, and they use that to obstruct my confirmation as administrator. America suffers, patients suffer, if we close our eyes to what we can learn from anyone anywhere on the planet. Using national exceptionalism as an excuse to blindfold ourselves just doesn't make any sense at all. The third knowledge-based problem is, I call, learning in large systems. This is pretty technical. I apologize to you, but try to stick with me. If you want to improve healthcare, you're going to engage a very messy world. You're not in a laboratory, you're in life. Experimentalist approaches to learning won't work. Mostly, evaluation sciences in healthcare remain tethered. They remain tethered to designs that are weak for learning, designs like randomized trials, which have a glorious place in the knowledge growth. But as what you're trying to change gets larger and more complex, you have got to adjust from evaluation to continual learning. Evaluation and learning are simply not the same task epistemologically. I'll prove it to you. Try telling your spouse that you're evaluating your marriage and see what happens. Actually, I suggest you don't do that. What you could do is ask, what could I try tomorrow that would make our marriage even better? And then you can try that. That confusion between evaluation and learning is strongly reflected in federal policy, in the Congressional Budget Office's scoring rules for legislation, and in decision-making in the Office of Management and Budget, two powerful and very well-run, very disciplined organizations. But this epistemology slows progress. It limits risk-taking. It discards lessons that come from the real world, from the field. A modern corporation that used CBO scoring rules to decide on the investments it makes in innovation would wither. It would be overtaken by corporations who embrace discovery, who understand prediction. This has been a chronic battle in the epistemology of improvement, and it's time for that battle to be over. The best image I know is the image you're looking at here from my colleague Lloyd Provost. What you see here is a picture of a still and peaceful pond. You could draw a sample of water from that pond, you could test it, and you would learn a lot about the pond. That's classical inference. That's census taking. The world of care, the world about which we have to learn in order to make care better, isn't a pond. It's the other picture you're looking at. It's of a rushing river, not of still waters. If you sample once from a river, you don't learn much about the future. The next sample, you don't know. Learning in this rushing rivers of change is an exercise in prediction. It's not an exercise in census taking, and the methods of learning that work in that torrent are simply not the same. The stewards of scientific inquiry right now are academicians, our journal editorial boards. These have they've neither sufficiently developed nor have they widely embraced new investigatory approaches, and I think it's time for them to do that.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I'm going to turn to the second cluster of obstacles, even a bit scarier. It's the topic of waste. The first I call naming the excess. America spends more on healthcare than it needs to. It spends a ton more than it needs to. A fifth grader would know that. All she'd have to do is look at the data on the relationships between per capita expenditure on healthcare among nations, in which we're nearly twice the next most expensive nation, and national health status and care outcomes, in which we rank in the 20s or 30s among nations for various metrics of our health. But nonetheless, it's much, much easier to sell the American public on the claim that we need more anything than less. These claims are good-hearted. They're being offered by people proud of the work they do. And you do need more. You need more if the chassis is broken, if the system isn't working. But it's become impossible to claim that enough is enough in the face of public fears of rationing, even though it is true. Enough is enough. This particular monster, the dimensions of excess in the care we have in this country, is the scariest one under the bed, I think. I'm going to show you how scary it can be, and I'm going to offend some of you in the room, I'm sure. But you have question and answer period to get back at me. This is a photograph of Dr. Bernard Laun. Dr. Laun is one of the most distinguished cardiologists in the world. He helped invent the modern defibrillator. He first worked out the relationships between potassium and digitalis. And he won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985 because he's a co-founder of the International Physicians for Prevention of Nuclear War that won the Peace Prize in 85. Dr. Laun is not a couch potato. He's 92 now. He's really sharp. For years, he's studied overuse in one area, the area of coronary revascularization procedures like stents and CABG operations. Dr. Laun has concluded, and he's written extensively about it. You can find it in the blogosphere about the evidence. He has concluded that half or more of the revascularization procedures done in the United States today for stable coronary disease, not unstable, but stable coronary disease, are unnecessary, half of them. They do not relieve symptoms any better than medical management if it's properly done. They don't lengthen life, and they don't prevent further heart attacks. Dr. Laun's belief in the practice within the cardiovascular group he started, the Laun Cardiovascular Group, rests on medical management of symptoms. And he has at least as much success as if the same patients had been managed invasively. The Laun Institute has the data. And by the way, it has never been sued in a malpractice case for the conservative approach to coronary disease. I spent a lot of time recently with Dr. Laun and with his colleague, Dr. Vikasaini. I find them convincing. There is a minority view in the cardiology community, but they're not alone in this view. Now, I am not a cardiologist, and I want to be clear, I am not presenting Dr. Laun's views to convince you of them. That would not be appropriate. But I want to raise a question about them. What if he were right? You have to check under the bed here. There's over 600,000 stents placed in coronary arteries in the U.S. each year, 500,000 CABG operations. Most of these patients have stable coronary disease. Just imagine for a minute what it would mean if Dr. Laun were right. All those angiography suites, all those gleaming operating rooms, all those proud and technically brilliant interventional cardiologists, proud of what they do, what happens to them? What happens to the business models of the heart hospitals or the stent vendors? When the evidence accumulates that what we do a lot of doesn't help nearly as much as we thought it did, it's scary to ask, and it's much easier not to. Now, there's a good side to this story. Courage is emerging. with the brilliant leadership of the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation, which has started the Choosing Wisely campaign, choosingwisely.org, and with Shannon Brownlee, a great author in this field now, interpreter for all of us, and the New America Foundation and a new effort, the nation is taking a much closer look at overtreatment, but we have to keep our wits about us. It's going to take courage to name and address the large proportion of American healthcare that just does not help. The forces to turn that inquiry aside are going to be massive. The good news is, imagine all the good we could do with what we could harvest back from the reduction of unscientific excess in care. We could put universal coverage within our reach. We could put programs and people where the need really is. We could build the new bridge. We have the resources. The next area of excess I want to talk about is even edgier, and that has to do with profit. We've come, I think, too much to accept the unbridled pursuit of revenue as okay, even when it's a destructive game. The American healthcare marketplace is an odd chimera. It's a combination of, on the one hand, generative, energizing entrepreneurship and proper competition, but on the other hand, calculating and cynical greed. We do not have methods sufficient in public policy, or I must say in private notice, to tell the difference between the two and to act on it. The administration right now, I think to its credit, is doing a very fine job in finding prosecuting, detecting outright fraud and criminal behavior, corruption. But that is not the same. That is not the same as interdicting greed. The army of greed is lawyers, and it can be legal. And greed, nonetheless, can be just as destructive as crime. It undermines the public trust. It undermines the treasury. I'm going to, at some risk, show you three stories. Makena. Makena is a simple chemical, 17-hydroxyprogesterone, that is effective and known for years to be effective in interrupting premature labor, which reduces low birth weight among babies. It's a very important tool. A course of treatment with generic 17-hydroxyprogesterone costs $15 a dose, or about $300. But a drug company, KV Pharmaceuticals, took advantage of a loophole in the orphan drug law to patent 17-hydroxyprogesterone as Makena, and then charge $25,000 for a course of treatment. Now, 50% of the births in this country are Medicaid births, and the threat and the cost of low birth weight are concentrated in families at economic and social disadvantage. The pharmaceutical company, I think to avoid pushback, heavily discounted Makena to patients who had private insurance, but applied the shelf price, $25,000, to Medicaid patients. The cost to Medicaid was over $1 billion a year. When the FDA issued guidance saying that it would be okay to rely on 17-hydroxyprogesterone from compounding pharmacies, who would provide the generic drug virtually at cost, the pharmaceutical company sued. It lost in federal court, but it tried. Second story, Colchris. That's colchicine. Colchicine has been used for the treatment of gout for 3,000 years. But technically, it's what's called an unapproved drug. When the FDA was formed, a whole bunch of drugs hadn't been approved. There was no FDA to approve it, so they were called unapproved until the FDA got around to reviewing it, usually initiated by a drug company. In this case, a company called URL Pharma in 2009 initiated a trial to study the 3,000-year-old drug for treatment of gout, colchicine. They called it Colchris. And then under the law, FDA had to give them exclusive rights to the production of this 3,000-year-old drug. Before it became Colchris, it cost 9 cents a pill. The price with URL Pharma was 50 times higher, $4.85 a pill, or up to $3,600 a year for patients previously paying 1/50th of that price. In 2007, the total Medicaid payment for colchicine was $1 million a year. For Colchris, same drug, it's $50 million a year. One other story. This is about erythropoietin and bundle payment. Let me explain. That's really technical. The very first Medicare bundled payment is for hemodialysis. Bundled payment means you pay for an episode of care instead of for the pieces of the episode. And it's a big move now in public policy. This is actually more like a bundlet, because what it did was put together the dialysis time, professional fees, and drugs for dialysis for one session. That's the bundlet. When the baseline was set for this bundle payment, how much you're going to pay for that treatment, the cost of erythrocyte-stimulating factor, EPO, was included, because the standard of care at that moment encouraged doctors to drive patients' hemoglobin levels upward above 10 grams per deciliter. In fact, under the Affordable Care Act, the quality incentive bonus for dialysis care was attached to hitting that target hemoglobin level. But while all that was playing out, the science changed, or it didn't actually change, but it was restudied, and it became clearer that high hemoglobin levels were associated in chronic renal failure with worse outcomes and that there was insufficient scientific evidence for maintaining hemoglobin at any specified level. So a revision of the quality incentive structure was issued while I was administrator, and the use of EPO had already begun to fall, and it fell further. But that was after the benchmark payment for the dialysis bundle was set with the EPO costs in the benchmark. So now you had a major windfall to the dialysis community. In essence, they kept receiving payment for the former rates of use of a drug whose use should and did decrease. The windfall approached $500 million in the first half of 2011. Now, I want to be clear. These companies and others, and I could, by the way, be talking about hospitals or physicians or any part or durable medical equipment account manufacturers. These people are doing what makes sense to them. They're playing by the rules. They're not doing anything illegal so far as I know. But that's my point. Not everything legal is proper. The rules are a problem. The payment rules, the pricing rules, the licensing rules, and so on, they leave much too much room for behaviors that, even if they are legal, are cynical, they're harmful, and they are extremely costly. Try to change them, check under the bed. The monsters are going to lurk if you try to change those rules. Civil society would have to give politicians and legislators a lot of courage to change the rules that are relevant here. We need, I think, to take some steps to draw lines between fair profit, which we surely can live with, and cynical greed, which I don't think we should.
Whatever you believe. trust to identify the enemy who took this country to war. Long before the peace was lost, who are the prophets for? Who are they who bear the cost? Who lay down their lives? Who will live with the sacrifice of our best and brightest hopes? The flower of our youth, of freedom and the truth.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.